Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday on this Valentine's Day, February 14th, a very happy birthday. We have several. William Amstutz from Mason City, Thomas D. Lloyd from Newton, Effie Riordan from Correctionville, Beverly Schultz from Marshalltown, Donna Smith from Cedar Rapids, Gerald Whitmore from Hampton, and Dwayne Zeal from Des Moines. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish all of you a very happy birthday and a very happy Valentine's Day. And you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television, on Iowa PBS, and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Ruth Marie Trusheim of Ankeny was born on April 8, 1929, at the family farm home in Custer Park, Illinois. She passed away on February 9th in Grimes, Iowa. She was the second of six children born to George and Pearl Austin. She graduated from Wilmington High School in 1947 and attended Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois, graduating with a Bachelor of Science degree in elementary education. Upon her graduation, she began teaching in Bloomington, Illinois, where she taught for 4 years. On July 9, 1955, she married Rudolph Trusheim in Symerton, Illinois. They made their home in Naperville, Illinois, where she taught until they moved to Iowa. The couple lived in Russell, Radcliffe, Dumont, Des Moines, Fort Dodge, and Waterloo, as Rudolph served different United Methodist churches. In each location, Ruth became involved in the school system as a substitute or full-time teacher. She loved teaching and loved the children as if they were her own. She completed her teaching career in Waterloo and retired to Urbandale. She lived the final years of her life at Kennybrook Village in Grimes. Ruth had many interests in life outside of teaching. She loved being a pastor's wife and especially enjoyed helping her husband with weddings. In retirement, she hosted the annual Urbandale Neighborhood Advent and Christmas brunch for many years. She loved to garden and enjoyed cooking for Trusheim holiday dinners. She was a tremendous baker, as anyone lucky enough to be on the receiving end of her caramel rolls, tea rings, or pies will attest to. Ruth was a member of Staves United Methodist Church, United Methodist Women, La Sertoma, and Kappa Delta Epsilon National Sorority in Education. Ruth was preceded in death by her beloved husband Rudolph and her parents and brothers George and Walter. She survived by two sons, five grandchildren, and five siblings. A celebration of Ruth's life will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 17th, at the Staves United Memorial Church, 2724 East Madison Avenue in Des Moines. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until service time at the church. Memorial contributions may be made to Staves Memorial United Methodist Church in loving memory of Ruth. Ruth will be greatly missed by her family and multitudes of friends. Kathleen, known as Kathy Amelia Smith, 66, passed away peacefully on Thursday, February 8th, at home, surrounded by her family. Kathleen was born in Des Moines on September 14, 1957, to Charles and Margaret Morris Smith. Kathy loved to sew, crochet, and paint things to go up around her home, or as gifts for her loved ones. With an independent spirit and a knack for art carpentry, she also enjoyed making incredible home remodeling transformations, often with very little outside help. Kathy regularly enjoyed going to bingo, the casino, and watching true crime or decorating shows. She was a selfless individual and would always put others' needs before her own. Family was everything to her, and she was often told she was a favorite. Kathy is survived by her loving husband, Stephen C., three children, eight grandchildren, and as well as one great-grandchild. She also has seven surviving siblings. Kathy was preceded in death by her parents, Charles and Margaret Smith, brother Daniel, and sister-in-law Terry. Services will be held on Saturday, March 30th, at 2 p.m., immediately followed by a celebration of life until 5 p.m. at the Colfax Historical Society, 900 North Washington Street. Pardon me, that's North Walnut Street in Colfax. Services are expected to last approximately 30 minutes. and Brandy Ernest Lehman of Urbandale, age 81, passed away surrounded by his loving family on January 31st. A public visitation will be held on February 16th from 3:30 p.m. until 5 p.m. at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory at 8201 Hickman Road in Urbandale, with a memorial service to follow at 5 p.m. To view a complete obituary or leave a condolence, please visit caldwellparish.com.
Thank you, Barb. That concludes our obituaries for today. Moving back now to some national news. Trump faces action in 5 court cases. Ex-president's calendar crowded amid campaign. Former President Donald Trump has a busy agenda in at least 5 courts this week, including expected decisions on whether he can continue to do business in New York and whether a federal trial on charges of election interference will be postponed. The variety of court hearings reflects the crowded litigation calendar Trump faces as he campaigns to return to the White House as the Republican frontrunner. On Monday, Trump attended a closed-door hearing in Fort Pierce, Florida, in a federal case alleging his mishandling of classified documents after leaving the White House. U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon met first with Trump and his lawyers to discuss access to evidence in the trial currently set for May 20th. Later in the day, Cannon met with Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith's team. Defense counsel shall be prepared to discuss their defense theories of the case in detail and how their any classified information might be relevant or helpful in the defense, Cannon wrote in a scheduling of the hearing. Prosecutors object to releasing the names of witnesses in the case and have recently revealed that a prospective government witness has received threats over social media that are now the subject of federal investigation. Also on Monday, Trump asked the Supreme Court to continue to delay a criminal trial into whether he tried to overturn the 2020 election while he appeals a lower court's ruling that he is not immune from prosecution. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 4 federal charges in the case before U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, 3 for conspiracy and 1 for obstruction, accusing him of falsely claiming election fraud and trying to overturn the legitimate election results. While former presidents have broad immunity from civil lawsuits for official actions taken while serving in the White House, Trump has attempted to claim sweeping immunity from criminal prosecution. Trump's lawyer, John Sauer, argued that a president should be shielded from criminal charges for his actions while in office, even after his term has ended, because otherwise political rivals could seek to punish him for contentious policy decisions. Without immunity from criminal prosecution, the presidency as we know it will cease to exist, Trump's lawyers told the court. A 3-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously ruled on February 6 that Trump can be tried for allegedly trying to steal the 2020 election. Experts described the 57-page opinion as a resounding rejection of Trump's claim of absolute immunity. For the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump with all of the defenses of any other criminal defendant, the panel wrote. Any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against this prosecution. Chutkan had scheduled Trump's trial for March 4th, but she put proceedings on hold in December while the immunity issue was being appealed. The appeals court agreed to continue postponing the trial, but only if Trump appealed to the Supreme Court. Trump has sought to push this and three other criminal trials he faces until after the November election. The arguments in this case come on the heels of the high court's hearing on whether Colorado can remove him from the state's presidential ballot for insurrection in the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Lawyers for Colorado and special counsel Jack Smith are seeking quick answers in both cases. In New York, State Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan scheduled a hearing for Thursday on charges Trump falsified business records in 2016 to pay an adult film actress and former Playboy model not to talk about their claims he had sex with them. Merchan had scheduled the trial to begin on March 25th, but pretrial work on the case paused while the federal cases took center stage, and the hearing could clarify how soon the case could go on trial. Also on Thursday, Georgia's Fulton County Superior Judge Scott McAfee will hold a potentially explosive televised hearing in the election interference case against Trump and 14 co-defendants. Trump and other defendants have asked to remove District Attorney Fannie Willis from the case because of her personal relationship with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. Willis and Wade have admitted in a recent court filing that they have been engaged in a, quote, personal relationship. But they said it began after Willis hired Wade to helm the high-profile case back in November of 2021. Willis said she hasn't benefited from the relationship financially and that she intends to remain on the case. Removing her could further delay a trial not expected to start until at least August. The judge suggested that both Willis and Wade are likely to testify at the hearing, which could extend through Friday, or possibly longer. Trump is not expected to be in attendance. Also, possible this week is a ruling for damages in the civil fraud case against Trump in New York. Supreme Court Justice Arthur N. Gorin has aimed to issue his ruling by mid-February after already ruling Trump and his namesake company committed fraud by overvaluing real estate repeatedly for years to gain benefits from lenders and insurers. And Gorin postponed his ruling after the New York Times reported that a witness, Trump's former chief financial officer, Alan Weisenberg, was negotiating a possible plea agreement for allegedly perjuring himself during the trial. Lawyers for Trump and State Attorney General Letitia James have urged and Gorin to issue his ruling without waiting for possible criminal charges against Weisenberg. James has asked for $370 million and a halt to Trump's doing business in New York, but Trump has vowed to appeal Engoron's ruling.
Biden goes on offense in border fight. President Joe Biden is hoping to make Republicans pay for their decision to torpedo a border security plan they demanded in the first place. In poll after poll, voters see Democrats in general, and Biden in particular, as weak on immigration and security at the U.S.-Mexico border. After the number of migrant border crossings reached an all-time high last year, congressional Republicans looked poised to capitalize on the situation. They held up funding for Ukraine's defense against Russia in exchange for tougher border restrictions. They figured they had the president painted into a corner. But in a stunning policy shift, the White House and Senate Democrats conceded and agreed to the most sweeping changes to immigration law in a generation. Then the Republicans, at the urging of former President Donald Trump, scuttled the bipartisan border deal that was 4 months in the making. Now Biden, moving from defense to offense, hopes to turn that legislative failure into a win for his reelection campaign. Quote, every day between now and November, the American people are going to know that the only reason the border is not secure is Donald Trump and his MAGA Republican friends, Biden said last week. The Biden campaign and Democratic allies hope independent voters will see that Biden was willing to reach across the aisle to reach a compromise, while Trump missed an opportunity to solve what he has long described as a national crisis. I think it goes beyond neutralizing the border issue. I think that Biden is taking control of the issue by really calling Republicans bluff, said Democratic pollster Matt Barreto, who advised Biden's 2020 presidential campaign on Latino issues. He's saying, I'm ready to act now. Now Republicans are on the defensive. They have to explain why they don't want to take action on the border. And so far, I haven't heard any good rationale. Trump, the frontrunner to win the Republican nomination, has long pushed hardline border policies, promising to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border, and now campaigning on the mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. Republicans, who for years have hammered the Democrats as soft on border security, are overwhelmingly viewed more favorably on the issue. An NBC poll last week found more voters view Trump by 57% to 22% as the better candidate than Biden to secure the border and control immigration. During negotiations on the $118 billion bill, most of which was designated as foreign aid for Ukraine and Israel, Biden embraced new, tougher rhetoric on the border. He called on Congress to give him the power to shut down the border to tackle what he started calling the border crisis. He acknowledged the border is not secure. After the bill's failure, Biden said he never thought I'd see something like I'm seeing now. Speaking last Wednesday to supporters at a New York fundraiser, he accused congressional Republicans of walking away because they've got Donald Trump calling and threatening them. Republicans scoffed at Biden's finger-pointing over the border, which they were quick to note has seen record numbers of migrants during Biden's presidency. Congressional Republicans who opposed the bill said it didn't go far enough, insisting on passage of their hard-line immigration bill, H.R. 2, which the Republican-controlled House approved last year. Understand that this border crisis is deliberate. Joe Biden caused it. He caused it by his own unilateral decisions, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, told reporters, adding that the purpose of the bipartisan border bill was to, quote, give political camouflage for Democrats running in November, end quote. Cruz said the bill wasn't intended to secure the border, but rather let every Democrat running for office say, gosh, I wanted to secure the border, but those mean Republicans wouldn't let me. This is all about talking points to deceive the voters, Cruz said. It's an utter lie. But Senator James Langford, Republican of Oklahoma, who helped lead negotiations in the Senate, has reinforced Biden's main point that election politics and Trump wanting to deny Biden a win got in the way of long-discussed progress on the border. In a speech on the Senate floor, Langford said he heard fellow conservatives say, it's the wrong time to solve the problem, or let the presidential election solve the problem. In fact, I had a popular commentator 4 weeks ago that I talked to that told me flat out, before they knew any contents of the bill, if you try to move a bill that solves the border crisis during this presidential year, I will do whatever I can to destroy you, Langford said. By the way, they have been faithful to their promise. A new National Public Radio Marist University poll found immigration currently ranks as the third most important issue for voters, trailing only the preservation of democracy and inflation. Only 29% approve of Biden's handling of immigration, compared with 60% who disapprove. By a 41% to 29% margin, voters said Republicans do a better job than Democrats of dealing with immigration. Quote, I know most Democrats think the failure of this bill will hurt Republicans, but I don't think it will, former Representative Joe Walsh, Republican of Illinois, an outspoken Trump critic, wrote on X, formerly Twitter. The polling on the border is baked in. Trump is a demagogue and an insurrectionist, but voters overwhelmingly believe that he is better on the border than Biden. Walsh said Biden ignored the border for 3 years, and I don't think what happens now changes that. Biden also faces a risk by campaigning on stronger border enforcement, with such rhetoric potentially turning off progressive voters, already upset by his unwavering support for Israel in its war against Gaza, along with immigrant advocates and some Latino voters. Barreto, who oversaw Hispanic research and focus groups for Biden's 2020 race, said he believes the potential for blowback is minimal because, unlike Trump, Biden is not advocating for mean-spirited, nasty policies.
Trump announces picks for new RNC leaders. Former President Donald Trump has endorsed North Carolina Republican Party Chairman Michael Whatley to succeed Ronna McDaniel as the Republican National Committee's next leader, according to a statement released Monday. Whatley previously served as a senior official in the George W. Bush administration and an advisor on the Trump-Pence campaign and has backed Trump's false claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election. He also pushed to censor former Senator Richard Burr after Burr voted to convict Trump for his alleged role inciting the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack. Whatley currently serves as the RNC's general counsel. The endorsement of Whatley comes as Trump's allies have criticized McDaniel for not being supportive of the former president as he seeks the Republican nomination in the 2024 race. The New York Times reported that McDaniel told Trump she plans to step down from her post after the South Carolina primary on February 24th. However, Republican National Committee spokesperson Keith Shipper told USA Today that nothing has changed and that McDaniel's plans will be decided after the primary. Along with Whatley, Trump said in a statement that Laura Trump, his daughter-in-law, has agreed to run the Republican National Committee's co-chair. In addition, Trump is tapping Chris LaCivita, his senior advisor, to assume the role of chief operating officer of the committee. The RNC must be a good partner in the presidential election. It must do the work we expect from the National Party and do it flawlessly, Trump said in a statement. That means helping to ensure fair and transparent elections across the country, getting out the vote everywhere, even in parts of the country where it won't be easy, and working with my campaign as the Republican presumptive nominee for president to win this election and make America great again. The committee would need to vote on Laura Trump and Whatley for them to officially assume their roles. LaCivita would have to be hired by the party's leadership, according to the Washington Post. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley's campaign manager, Betsy Ankeny, said in a response to Trump's plans that Haley's plan is to fire everyone at the Republican National Committee. Nikki Haley's plan for the RNC? Blow it all up. Everyone at the RNC will be fired. There will be a full and complete audit of the gross misuse of funds, and there will be a formal application process to become RNC chair based on merit, not on back-scratching. The days of overpaid consultants getting rich off of the RNC while losing elections will be over, and Republicans will finally get back to winning, Ankeny said in a statement. At a campaign stop in Bamberg, South Carolina, Haley reacted to Trump's attempted RNC takeover. Quote, "Is that how you're going to try and take an election?" she said.
Estonia says Putin plans a buildup on the border. Republican President Vladimir Putin plans to double the number of his country's troops stationed along its border with the Baltic states and Finland as part of Moscow's preparations for a potential military conflict with NATO within the next decade, Estonia's former Foreign Intelligence Service said Tuesday. The assessment was made in an annual report released by Estonia's Foreign Spy Agency. Kapo Rosen, its director general, told reporters that Russia has chosen a path which is a long-term confrontation. Rosen is the latest Western official to warn that Moscow still harbors an appetite for conflict and represents an unpredictable threat to countries on NATO's eastern flank, nearly 2 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. However, Rosen stressed that Russia is highly unlikely to attack a NATO country in the short term. We see the Russians, in their own thinking, are calculating military conflict with NATO as possible in the next decade, he said. Russians are planning to increase the military force along the Baltic states border, but also the Finnish border. We will highly likely see an increase in manpower, about doubling perhaps. We will see an increase in armed personnel carriers, tanks, artillery systems over the coming years. The Estonian intelligence report comes as likely Republican U.S. presidential nominee Donald Trump said over the weekend that he would encourage Russia to do whatever the hell they want to any NATO member country that doesn't meet the 31-nation military organization's defense spending guidelines, currently 2% of GDP. NATO, quote, "NATO was busted until I came along," Trump said in a rally at Conway, South Carolina. "I said, everybody's going to pay." They said, "Well, if we don't pay, are you still going to protect us?" I said, "Absolutely not." They couldn't believe the answer, end quote. Rosen said Trump's comments weren't helpful, adding, "But probably the Russians are paranoid enough not just to listen to the words which are said, but they will definitely look at the actions." It also comes as Ukraine is running low on weapons in its fight with Russia. The U.S. Senate approved $95 billion in emergency funding for Ukraine and Israel on Tuesday, but the bill's fate in the House of Representatives remains unclear and likely faces an uphill battle there with Republicans. Under one scenario forecast by Estonia's intelligence service, Russia could double the 19,000 troops it has positioned near Estonia. Russia's troop presence near Finland, with which it shares an 830-mile border, has so far been fairly small. But that is almost certain to change, the intelligence report said, not least because Finland recently became a NATO member. The report said Russia's formation will probably be built around at least two or three maneuver units, with around a dozen fire support and combat support units. Estonia gained its independence from the former Soviet Union in 1991. It became a NATO member in 2004. A growing number of Western officials have been sounding the alarm over Russia's military intentions in recent months, saying that Putin's veiled threats to attack NATO countries could turn out to be real. Germany's Defense Minister Boris Pistorius warned in late January that we hear threats from the Kremlin every day and that, for now, our experts expect a period of 5 to 8 years in which this, that is an attack on NATO countries, could be possible. Denmark's Defense Minister Troels Lund Poulsen made similar comments last week.
Here's some weather news. Winter storm dumps heavy snow on the Northeast. Schools and airports hit hard across multiple states. Snowplows made their triumphant return to New York City for the first time in 2 years Tuesday as a powerful, fast-moving nor'easter unleashed fast-falling snow across the Mid-Atlantic and New England regions. Parts of Pennsylvania and New York's Hudson Valley reported double-digit snow totals by 8 a.m., and more than 135,000 Pennsylvania utility customers lost power, according to a database maintained by USA Today. But the snow came out by late afternoon, but the sun came out by late afternoon, melting much of the snow in places like Maryland, southeastern Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, as temperatures climbed to near 50 degrees in Baltimore and 38 in New York City. Snow totals varied widely from Virginia to Massachusetts, with some areas receiving as much as 15.5 inches in Farmington, Connecticut, and others as little as a trace, according to the National Weather Service. In New York City, Coney Island received nearly 7 inches of snow, while Central Park saw about half that. Still, the city's emergency management commissioner said it marked the most snow the city has seen in 2 years. Bracing for the worst of the storm, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu announced a snow emergency and closed all public schools, affecting more than 54,000 students and their parents. In the end, the city got just 3 inches, according to AccuWeather. New York City, the country's largest public school system, switched all schools to online learning, affecting 1.1 million students and their parents, then reported widespread login issues. New Jersey closed all state government offices. The rapid snowfall caused mass cancellations at New York's LaGuardia Airport and delayed subway trains, frustrating commuters and tourists alike. Across the region, more than 1,100 flights were canceled as of 11 a.m., according to FlightAware. The storm hit as some New Yorkers went to the polls in the special election to replace former U.S. Representative George Santos, who was expelled in December. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb DeHeck and Dennis May, and it has been our pleasure to read for you on this day. And now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are myself, Scott Splavik, and Patty Daniels. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Patty with our next article.
Thank you. We'll start with the opinion page. NRA, Trump have the same pitch of fear and greed. Written for us by Chris Brennan. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Donald Trump on Friday acknowledged his cowardice when it comes to America's epidemic of gun violence and the resulting slaughter of this country's children. Being Trump, he tried to make that sound like a virtue. Speaking at a National Rifle Association gun show in Pennsylvania's capital city today, Trump bragged about the record of inaction. During my 4 years, nothing happened, Trump said, and there was great pressure on me having to do with guns. We did nothing. We didn't yield. That's Trump telling the truth for a change. Here's what did happen. From January 20, 2017 to January 29, 2021, Trump's time as president, the country saw 1,714 mass shootings in which four or more people were killed or wounded, with 1,679 deaths and 7,355 injuries. Every Town for Gun Safety, a nonprofit that advocates for solutions to stop gun violence, told me this. Trump didn't mention that in his NRA speech. He also skipped the text, of course, of the moment 6 years ago when he suggested making changes to gun laws that the NRA didn't want, while accusing other Republicans of being too afraid to do it before eventually backing down. Trump can't stand up to the NRA because they're too alike. They sell the same product, division. They turn your fear into their money. Trump uses that money to seek power and avoid responsibility, funneling campaign contributions to lawyers in his criminal and civil cases. The NRA uses that money to live large, private jets, luxury vacations, bespoke wardrobes, all while masquerading as a defender of good old plain-spoken American folk. Its leaders have long since made up from the momentary disagreement during Trump's one term as president. To be clear, the NRA doesn't serve the crowd assembled Friday at the Pennsylvania Farm Show complex to hear Trump. It's a lobbying arm of this country's gun manufacturers. The NRA doesn't just want you to buy a gun. It wants you to buy as many guns as you can. And just like with Trump, division is its best marketing tactic. The NRA's constant clamor is Democrats want to seize guns from everyone. Its pitch is always about the good guy with a gun standing up in a shootout with a bad guy with a gun. Guess what the good guy and the bad guy have in common? They both are armed with guns manufactured by companies that the NRA values more than your life. Wednesday marked 6 years since a massacre at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where a 19-year-old used a semi-automatic rifle to murder 14 students and three staff members. Trump hosted a White House meeting on gun reform 2 weeks after that, where he accused Republicans in a bipartisan group of legislators of avoiding some firearm issues because you're afraid of the NRA. On the table in that meeting, Trump openly considered raising the age requirement from 18 to 21 to purchase an assault rifle and making it easier to seize guns from people considered a danger to themselves or others. But he also supported an NRA-backed plan to arm teachers in schools. Who's afraid of the NRA? That's all Trump. And why? The NRA spent more than $38 million to help Trump defeat Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential election. as in 2020, as the NRA was splintering with an internal conflict about lavish spending by its leaders, the group still spent more than $16 million in Trump's losing battle against Joe Biden. This has never been about guns for Trump or the NRA. It's about money. This has never been about guns for Trump or the NRA. Wayne LaPierre, the NRA leader who resigned last month, acknowledged in testimony during a civil trial that he spent the group's money and accepted gifts from vendors to live a lifestyle of private flights, luxury vacations, and tailored suits. He's gone, but the gun grift goes on. Trump's speech Friday was the closing event for the NRA's Great American Outdoor Show. A ticket to beat Trump costs $15. A ticket to hear Trump costs $15 or came free with a new membership with the group, which ranges from $45 for 1 year or $1,500 for a lifetime membership. Charles Cotton, the NRA president, introduced Trump, saying the group had no greater friend than the former president. The crowd, many wearing attire emblazoned with Trump's Make America Great Again motto, welcomed him enthusiastically when he took the stage. But Trump soon turned lethargic, sounding weary amid the crowd, and the crowd matched his energy as he rattled off a rolling repetition of his usual grievances about immigration and crime and the economy. He twice predicted a 100% chance of a major terrorist attack in the near future and the advent of World War III if he is not elected president again. An entire generation of young people could very well be decimated by something that could very well happen, Trump said of that imagined war. He didn't dare touch on the generations that have seen classmates murdered and wounded at school. Trump rarely seems to learn from his mistakes, but crossing the NRA is not a misstep he will repeat. The man who wants to be America's president again has a new approach to the slaughter of children in classrooms. Get over it. Campaigning last month ahead of the Iowa caucuses, Trump addressed a recent school shooting that left an 11-year-old boy and his principal dead and six wounded before the 17-year-old gunman killed himself. "It's just horrible. So surprising to see it here," Trump said, while campaigning for an office where, by his own account, he did nothing to stop this sort of thing. "But we have to get over it. We have to move forward." School shootings are sadly no longer surprising. Neither is Trump's shrug at the slaughter and eagerness to move ahead and cash in with the NRA without doing anything to stop it. And you can follow USA Today elections columnist Chris Brannon on X.
Thanks, Patty. Our next opinion piece is entitled "Valentine's Day Also Is Donor Day and My Life Is on the Line." It's written by Yono Pernomo, who is the owner of Yono's restaurant located in Albany, New York. "For nearly 50 years, February 14th has looked the same for my wife, Donna, and me. After a long day of work at our restaurant, Yono's, we sit down to enjoy a peaceful Valentine's Day dinner. But this year, February 14th, has taken on a new meaning for us because my life is on the line. This Valentine's Day, Donna and I will be honoring National Donor Day, a day we didn't know existed until our lives were changed forever last April when I was diagnosed with end-stage renal failure and was told I needed a kidney transplant to save my life. Since then, I have been undergoing daily dialysis, a debilitating and time-consuming medical procedure that helps the body remove excess fluid and waste from the blood when the kidneys are not able to, but it cannot save my life. In order to spend many more Valentine's days with my soulmates, I need a kidney transplant. As of today, across the United States, I am one of more than 100,000 people waiting for a life-saving organ, nearly 90,000 of whom are in need of a kidney like me, with another person added to the transplant list every 10 minutes. Nationwide, the average waiting time for a kidney transplant is 3 to 5 years, but in my home state of New York, more than 1,000 residents have been waiting 5 or more years for a kidney transplant. The consequences of these long wait times often are tragic. Each day, 17 Americans die while waiting for a transplant. While one organ donor can save 8 lives and heal 75 more through eye and tissue donation, there is a severe shortage of donors. The odds are stacked against Donna and me, but that's nothing new. When we met aboard the SS Rotterdam cruise ship nearly 50 years ago, no one, including the two of us, could have ever imagined the life and love that the future would hold. I was one of the ship's few Indonesian crew members, and she was a passenger whose beauty and talent caught my eye at the piano bar one night when she stood up to sing. It was the 1970s, and interracial marriage was not yet common in the United States, but that didn't stop us. We were married during a snowstorm 2 years later and started a family soon after with our 2 children, Dominic and Alexandra. Today, Donna and I are also the proud grandparents of 3 wonderful granddaughters, Gemma, Haley, and Blair. I'm fighting for my life, for each of them. While as of 2019, 90% of all eligible Americans favored organ donation, only half were actually registered as organ donors. It's time that we close that gap. To do so, Donna and I have become involved with Donate Life New York State, a nonprofit dedicated to increasing organ, eye, and tissue donations. The work of Donate Life New York State is critical. Last year, 85% of all transplants nationwide came from deceased donors. After a decade of Donate Life New York State's legislative advocacy efforts to increase opportunities for New Yorkers to become organ donors, enrollment numbers have encouragingly doubled, but we still have a long way to go. I am forever grateful to have been blessed with a wife as remarkable as Donna, who has truly lived up to our vows to care for me in sickness and in health, including by working with our daughter, Alexandra, to develop the YONO Needs, a kidney campaign to help find me a match. At the same time, I know that not everyone in my position is fortunate enough to have such a loving and supportive partner. So this Valentine's Day and National Donor Day, I ask that if you haven't already, please register to become an organ donor and encourage your family and friends to do the same. There is no act more loving than giving someone a second chance at life.
We're going on to the sports section, and I'm going to read the sports on TV for Wednesday, today, February 14th. Auto racing, 8 p.m., FS1 NASCAR Cup Series, pole qualifying, Daytona International Speedway, Daytona Beach, Florida. Canadian Hockey League at 7, NHLN Niagara versus Brie. College basketball, men's, 6:30 p.m., BTN Michigan State at Penn State. 7 p.m., Georgia Tech at Notre Dame on ACCN, and on CBSSN, Xavier at Seton Hall, ESPN2, Miami, Florida at Clemson, on ESPNU, Tulsa at South Florida, 8:30, BTN, Iowa at Maryland, SSCN, South Carolina at Auburn, 9 p.m., CBSSN, UConn at DePaul, ESPN2, Tennessee at Arkansas, ESPNU, Western Carolina at Samford, PAC, 12N, Oregon State at Arizona State, and at 10, FS1, Utah State at Wyoming, 11 p.m., CBSSN, UNLV at Fresno State. College basketball, women's, 7 p.m. on Peacock. Nebraska at Iowa State, 8 p.m. Peacock. Indiana at Wisconsin. Now for the golf, 5 a.m. Thursday, Golf Ladies European Tour. The Aramco Saudi Ladies International First Round Riyadh Golf Club, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And lacrosse, men's, 5:30 p.m., ESPN2, PLL, Championship Series, California versus Boston, Round Robin, Springfield, Virginia. NBA basketball, 7:40 p.m. ESPN Chicago at Cleveland. 10:05 p.m. on ESPN LA Clippers at Golden State. NHL hockey, 7:30 p.m. TNT and Max, Florida at Pittsburgh. True TV, Florida at Pittsburgh, Chicklets Cast. Soccer, men's, 3 p.m. CBS UEFA Championship League, Real Sociedad at Paris Saint-Germain, round of 16, leg 1. 7:55, FS2, CONCACAF Champions Cup, Vancouver at Tigres UANL, first round, leg 2. 10:05 p.m. FS2 CONCACAF Champions Cup. Real Estelí at Club America, first round, leg 2. And tennis, 5 a.m. Tennis at Doha WTA, Rotterdam ATP, Buenos Aires ATP, Delray Beach ATP, early rounds. And lastly, the tennis, Doha WTA, Rotterdam ATP, Buenos Aires ATP, Delray Beach ATP, early rounds.
Thank you, Patty. Continuing with sports, let's read this article about the state high school boys wrestling tournament that's going on this week, I believe starting today. How Golf Gave SEP's Pearson Confidence for State Tourney. It's written by Ellie McCowan of the Des Moines Register. It's the boys' wrestling Class 3A state semifinals, and Southeast Polk's Carter Pearson and Norway's Tyler Harper are set to square off. Pearson is undoubtedly the heavy favorite, sitting as the number one seed, 40 wins, one loss on the season, and one of the hottest names in recruiting circles in his sophomore year. Across from him, however, is Harper. He earned the number 4 seed in his first appearance in the boys' state tournament. Despite this being his first time, he was undeterred and in his pursuit to make a run in the tournament. It showed in the match as Harper engaged in some hand fighting and dumped Pearson down for a pin in just 18 seconds to advance to the 106-pound final. I knew if I was on the bottom half of the bracket, I would make it to the finals, Harper said after beating Pearson. I made it either way, but it was just a tougher opponent to go through on the top half of the bracket. Pearson went on to finish in third place at 106 pounds, and Harper finished second behind Iowa City West's Alexander Pierce. After the loss, Pearson was admittedly devastated. He saw a chance to win his first state title slip from his fingers. It was really unexpected, Pearson said. It really sucked, but I had to work hard. I had to start working hard so stuff like that doesn't happen again. His wrestling skills and technique weren't the issue. The majority of his off-season work didn't have to be done there. For Pearson, it was the mental aspect of the sport that he needed to work on, particularly his confidence. So what did Pearson do to work on that? He turned to his other passion, golf. Anyone who golfs regularly knows how frustrating golf can be. That drive off the tee into the woods, the putt that didn't have enough juice to make the hole, or a shot into the pond are all enough to make a person channel their inner Happy Gilmore. So it might be a bit confusing why Pearson turned to golf to help him improve his mental game. In reality, it makes a ton of sense when you consider the comparables between golf and wrestling. 5 hours on the course isn't all that different from an all-day tournament, and whether you are out on the green or on the wrestling mat, you're on your own. You don't have a teammate that can clean up your mistake. It's you versus the world. It helps a lot, Pearson said. You got to be mentally strong and can't let things get to you. Making a one-time state champion feel like he needs to take a shot to prevent being on bottom again is leaps and bounds ahead of where Pearson was last year. His confidence exuded in that moment against one of the state's best wrestlers. Even Knight had to show his respect, making sure to give him a tap on the rear on a job well done following the bout. That growth has earned the attention of not only the state's high school wrestling community, but the college realm as well. Pearson said the attention he got on the first day he was allowed to be contacted by coaches was crazy back this summer, earning attention from Power 5 programs like Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa State. Being the great student he is as well, he's taken visits at Cornell and Columbia to wrestle and study engineering if he remains on that path. He and Southeast Polk are front runners in their respective title races at the Boys State Wrestling Tournament, which runs Wednesday through Saturday. If Pearson wants a chance to come out on top this time, his confidence is going to have to continue through the end of the tournament. He's the only one that holds himself back, Southeast Polk wrestling coach Jake Agnich said. He's awesome. He deserves it. Hopefully, we can keep this train rolling. Patty, back to you.
Thank you. Real quick, I will read this article. Fran and Margaret McCaffrey raised nearly $131,000 for the AYA Cancer Program, written for us by Tyler Toffman of the Register and the USA Today Network. Iowa City, Margaret McCaffrey, wife of Hawkeye head coach Fran McCaffrey, held up a large check during a stoppage in Sunday's men's basketball team between Iowa and Minnesota. It signified a substantial monetary contribution. The McCaffreys raised $130,000. That is nearly $131,000 for the Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Program. The program, which is a joint effort between the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital and the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center, specializes in addressing the needs of people from the 13 to the 30s as they deal with cancer. We'll continue to work extremely hard with, as I said before, the help of a lot of different people, Fran McCaffrey said, following the game about the monetary gift. Just really proud of Margaret. This battle hits home on a personal level to the McCaffrey family. Margaret and Fran's son, Patrick, was diagnosed with thyroid cancer as a teenager. Patrick, a cancer survivor, now plays for his father on the Iowa men's basketball team. On the recent day that Margaret held a giant check at Carver Hawkeye Arena, Patrick also scored 21 points in Iowa's improbable 20-point comeback victory over Minnesota. Fran McCaffrey and his family have been strong advocates in the fight against cancer. An annual McCaffrey fundraising event started in 2011 has raised more than $1.25 million for cancer support at the U of I hospitals and clinics, according to the UI Center for Advancement. Following Iowa's win over Ohio State on February 2nd, Fran McCaffrey, unprompted, brought up the University of Iowa Dance Marathon being held that weekend. The student organization, highlighted by a 24-hour fundraising event, provides support to young cancer patients and their families. Dance Marathon has raised more than $30 million over the last three decades. This game is not the most important thing that's happening on our campus, Fran McCaffrey said after Iowa's win over Ohio State. The group of students that participate in the dance marathon is one of the most impressive things I've seen. I've been actively involved with them a number of times. McCaffrey continued, It's a year-long process that they commit to, and it's impressive, and it speaks to the character of our student body. Proud to commend them on the job that they do. And you can follow the author of this, Tyler Tachman, on X.
Now it's time to read Dear Abby. Mother can't understand why son has walked away. Dear Abby, I've always been close to my children, but now that they are adults, it seems I'm losing my connection with one of them. He married a girl of a different race, and while that doesn't bother me, I have a strong hunch she's the reason he has distanced himself from not only me, but also the rest of the family. When I recently shared with him that I felt his wife is a bit of a busybody and had overstepped some boundaries, he told me he no longer wants a relationship with me. I don't think I said anything so bad that he'd totally remove himself from our lives, but I'm no longer going to try to force him to be a part of this family. After I blocked his wife from social media, because she doesn't interact but stalks and then reports back to him, he has blocked me. I'm usually good at dealing with conflict, but he's steadily drawing further and further away. I love all my children, but he needs to realize it's not all about his wife. We're his family, too. I really need help with this one. Signed, Adult's Mom. Dear Adult's Mom, leaving your daughter-in-law and her race out of this for a moment, the situation you have described is one that sometimes happens when a son gets married. When that happens, the young man's allegiance switches from mom and family to his wife. Your daughter-in-law, reviewing your posts and discussing them with your son, isn't outrageous, particularly if he isn't viewing them himself. Were you posting something she found hurtful or offensive? If the answer is no, you may have to accept that, for whatever reason, your son has decided to move in a different direction. If the answer is yes, offer an apology and see if it's possible to bury the hatchet. And Patty, you want to read the second one?
Dear Abby, my husband of 30 years and I are in-house separated. We sleep in separate bedrooms. I want a divorce, but he refuses to leave, even though he could afford another house. Our grown son came to visit recently and was staying in our camper in our backyard. The camper is next to our swimming pool. Last Sunday, I looked out the kitchen window and saw my husband standing in the pool naked. Our son was in the camper at the time and came out to see his father standing there. When I asked my husband why he did this, my question was met with rage and yelling that he didn't want to get his bathing suit wet. Don't you think this is the behavior of a depraved person? Finished in Florida. Dear Finished, for your son to have seen his father naked in the swimming pool isn't what is cause for concern. More alarming is that a change in his usual behavior may indicate a mental or emotional problem and calls for a medical evaluation. He might be more open to it if your son suggests it. Please consult an attorney and ask what would be involved if you were to go through with divorce. Get those answers now before a crisis happens. And from Abby, dear readers, on this day that celebrates love, I want you to know how much I value the relationship I have with you. Wishing all of you a happy Valentine's Day. With love, Abby.
That brings us to the end of today's Des Moines Register. I'm Scott Blavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer, smart device, at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading information service.